This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So good afternoon and welcome to the 5th annual UCSF School of Dentistry Global Oral Health Symposium. My name is Benjamin Chaffee. I am the director of our program in Global Oral Health at the School of Dentistry, and I am delighted to see how many people have come out today to see our lineup and support our program, and I expect we'll see more people filing in as the afternoon moves along. So our program and our event, this is now our 5th year, has truly grown as the years have gone by. Really excited by the support we've seen. I think that speaks to certainly the quality of the lineup. We have some outstanding speakers to present today, and we're very proud to have them with us. I think this reflects a really growing interest in global health as a concept in education, as far as it applies to professional education among dentists. I strongly believe that the ideas of making sustainable impacts, of understanding the social determinants of health, of working in an interdisciplinary nation, in an interdisciplinary way with our colleagues, are all principles that are going to separate our graduates as true professionals as opposed to technicians of the mouth. So our theme today is nutrition, sugar, and oral health worldwide. And it's very tempting to say that this is a timely topic, that it could not be more timely as the effects of sugar and nutrition on our health become so profound. This is our 5th annual symposium, and there would not have even been a first if it wasn't for the leadership of Dr. John Greenspan, our first dean for global oral health here at UCSF. It is his vision and forward thinking that brought us all together and made this program possible. You'll hear me thank him many times, but first a thank you and applause to him. And finally, we couldn't be doing this program if it wasn't for the leadership and support of our dean, Dr. John Featherstone, who's been just tremendously supportive. You'll hear him say that global oral health is part of the mission and the strategic plan for our school. We couldn't be more happy about that. It sets the culture all the way from our leadership to our students and everyone working together. So right now, one thing we've always liked to incorporate into our annual symposium is to reach out and bring in our colleagues from organized dentistry. We think it's very important. This is not just an academic exercise, but this allows us to connect to dentists in practice and the rest of our profession. And we're very honored to have the president-elect of the American Dental Association, Dr. Carol Summerhays, come join us. She's been a huge friend of our School of Dentistry at UCSF, and we're honored to have her.
Good afternoon. It's always a pleasure to be back at UCSF. The top-ranking dental school in research funding from the National Institute of Health for over 20 years and a global leader in oral health. I want to thank Dr. Chaffee and Dr. Featherstone and Dr. Greenspan for the opportunity to make a few comments about the American Dental Association's role in national and global oral health. But before beginning, I'd like to acknowledge Dr. John Greenspan, who was the recipient of the 2012 ADA Gold Medal for Excellence in Dental Research. This award is made every 3 years to honor individuals who contribute to the advancement of the profession of dentistry and for making major improvements in the oral health of the public through basic and clinical research. Congratulations, Dr. Greenspan. The theme of sugar, nutrition, and oral health is very timely with the release of the World Health Organization 2015 guideline, Sugars Intake for Adults and Children. And currently, we are under review of the 2015 Dietary Guidelines for Americans, to which the ADA has submitted comments to the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. On the global stage, the ADA works through the FDI, World Dental Federation. The FDI is comprised of 200 national member associations and specialist groups from over 130 countries, representing a million dentists. The mission is to promote the optimal oral and general health for all peoples. Since its inception in 1900, the ADA has contributed organizational leadership and expertise, particularly in the areas of science and public health. Dr. Michael Glick, Dean at SUNY Buffalo and editor of the Journal of the American Dental Association, led the efforts for FDI's Vision 2020. Its aim is to generate discussion and collaboration among the FDI and its partners to shape the future of oral health. I must also mention that the ADA is fortunate to have Dr. Tauger Decker as JADA's editorial board, so thank you for adding your expertise. Now, in the audience, I'd like to introduce Dr. Dan Meyer. Dan, would you stand up? Dan is the ADA's chief science officer, and he's been with the ADA for over 19 years. Dr. Meyer is an expert consultant representing the ADA and outside organizations, including global initiatives at the FDI, the WHO, and the IADR. Now, during the negotiations of the United Nations Environmental Protection Treaty, Dan worked very closely with the FDI and IADR to save the use of amalgam as a restorative material. In the final UNEP treaty, there is a statement that supports strengthening disease prevention and health promotion as the most relevant approach to reducing the need for restorative care. So thank you for that, Dan. Now, many of the ADA's agencies are involved in sugar, nutrition, and oral health. The Council on Science has a caries management subcommittee, and they're developing plans for a national call to action to promote a caries management approach focused on disease prevention by reducing caries risk factors. We also in the audience have the chair of the Council on Access and Prevention. So, Dr. Jane Gillette, would you stand? So thank you for being here. The Council has just recently forwarded a resolution to support the WHO guidelines on sugar intake and has encouraged the development and implementation of a comprehensive plan to promote nutritional screening and counseling as a part of routine dental care. So thank you. And through the Council on Dental Benefits, we support efforts to require third-party payers to recognize nutrition counseling in the dental office as an eligible plan benefit. Very important for our dentist. The ADA also offers educational modules to help dentists counsel patients about the importance of maintaining good oral health. And in addition to producing patient brochures on healthy dietary habits, we maintain a consumer website, mouthhealthy.org, as a resource for the public. And recently, we established an interagency sugar and caries work group to develop a policy statement to reduce sugar consumption as a means of reducing caries risk. Now, much of our work involves advocacy at the federal level. Our Council on Government Affairs and our Washington, D.C. office have been instructed to advocate for increased research funding regarding the role that sugar plays in the development of caries for both the National Institute of Dental and Craniofacial Research and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Just last week, on April 29th, ADA President Maxine Feinberg testified before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Labor, Health, and Human Services and Education. We requested $425 million for NIDCR research for fiscal year 2016 and urged the NIDCR to use a portion of its resources to conduct more research on the effects of added sugars and artificial sweeteners on oral health. This request is an increase of over $8 million over the 2015 budget. And in the past 10 years, NIDCR appropriations have been reduced by 25% in inflation-adjusted dollars. The ADA has been a strong advocate for including oral health education in team nutrition, SNAP-Ed, WIC, and other food assistance programs. we have pushed the USDA to adopt nutrition standards that promote optimal oral health for all foods offered in schools and to also include oral health education in local school wellness programs. We support the FDA's proposal to require a separate line for added sugars on nutrition and supplemental fat labels to help consumers monitor their added sugar intake. In her testimony, Dr. Feinberg urged other federal research agencies to carve out a role for oral health when conducting any nutritionally related research. Any strategy to improve the dietary habits of Americans can and must include an oral health component. So we all have a role to play: students, faculty, academic institutions, organized dentistry, and other national health organizations. Strong collaboration among the stakeholders is key to our mutual success. So thank you for your time to give you a few of our efforts at the American Dental Association on behalf of oral health.
Well, good afternoon. Many of us in this room have spent their whole professional career trying to alter the epidemic of dental caries, either through community efforts or individual efforts, using strategies based on the intake of fluorides, oral hygiene instruction, or the form and frequency of sugar. Attacking the form and frequency of sugar has been very frustrating, and Kristen Kearns, who will be presenting next, has rolled back the covers to let us know what barriers that we fought against for all these 40 years trying to address this effort. So Kristen Kearns is a postdoctoral scholar at the University of California, San Francisco, with a joint appointment in the Phil Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies in the School of Medicine and the Department of Oral and Craniofacial Sciences at the School of Dentistry. Additionally, she's an acting instructor at the University of Washington School of Dentistry. Her degrees include a BA in neuroscience from Trinity College, a DDS from the University of North Carolina School of Dentistry, and an MBA in Health Administration from the University of Colorado in Denver. Dr. Kearns first became interested in sugar policy and her role as operation manager for the Kaiser Permanente Dental Care Program in 2007. While attending the annual Institute for the Oral Health Conference focusing on periodontal disease and diabetes, she received instructions on what to discuss with patients with diabetes from the program director of the National Diabetes Education Program at the Centers for Disease Control. Under healthy food choices, limitations were recommended for saturated fats and salt, but there was no mention of limitations for sugar intake. After challenging the second keynote speaker, who promoted the same thing, she was told there is no evidence linking sugar to chronic disease. After years of counseling dental patients to reduce their intake of sugars to help manage oral disease, especially as the dental director of a low-income clinic, the lack of advice on sugars to diabetics seemed conspicuous. Did the science support the mission, or were there other forces at play? Drawing from her scientific background and learning from pioneers challenging the conventional wisdom, Dr. Kearns began focusing on trade associations that promoted the consumption of sugars to look for answers. Kearns discovered the papers in a collection that was left to the University of Illinois Library by the late Roger Adams, a professor emeritus of organic chemistry who served on the Sugar Research Foundation and the Scientific Advisory Board of the International Sugar Research Foundations, which became the World Sugar Research Organization. By herself, in the University of Illinois Library, She copied at her own expense over 1,500 pages of correspondence among sugar industry executives, meeting minutes and other relevant reports from between 1959 and 1971. As a postdoctoral scholar at the University of California, San Francisco, along with her mentors and co-authors Stan Glantz and Laurel Schmidt, she has used the UCSF platform that was successful in the tobacco wars to unmask the sugar industry's influence on the government and the disregard of the health of the American people and the world. So, Christian Kearns.
Thank you, Steve, for that nice introduction, and thank you to Ben Chaffee, John Greenspan, Dean Featherstone, and the rest of the organizing committee for inviting me to speak here today. I'm thrilled to be able to participate and share my work with you. Steve actually gave a little bit of my presentation for me here, but I'll expand a little bit on it. As going back to 2007, where I was attending a dental conference in a role as operations manager for the dental program at Kaiser Permanente in Oregon and Washington. And I was really excited about medical dental integration possibilities. We had physicians and dentists under the same roof, and we actually had access to their medical electronic health record. So as dentists in that program, we were looking for ways that we could help manage diabetic patients. And I went to a conference put on by Washington Dental Services. George Taylor was speaking at that conference, as a matter of fact, and learned some interesting things. So I went home with a packet of these pamphlets, Working Together to Manage Diabetes, designed for educating dentists in practice and how they can aid in the effort of controlling chronic disease. And the diet advice, as Steve mentioned, was to increase fiber, limit saturated fats, and limiting salt would help control blood glucose, blood pressure, and cholesterol. But there was no mention of restricting sugar intake. And this was from the CDC, NIH, National Diabetes Education Program. So I was a little bit flustered. I wasn't quite sure where that was coming from. And then the second keynote speaker, Dr. Stephen Aldana, handed this booklet out at the end of his talk, The Stop and Go Fast Food Nutrition Guide. And in the first few pages, there was a ranking of drinks, and Lipton Brisk Sweet Tea got a green light, which was 44 grams of sugar, recommended as a healthy drink. And I actually jumped up and chased him down and said, wait a minute, how can you possibly recommend sweet tea as a healthy drink? And his answer, there is no evidence that links sugar to chronic disease. So it's not quite what I expected to get out of that conference, but I walked away wondering what's going on. So on my own time, I just started to look up who is the sugar industry. I really don't know anything about them. And I came upon sugar.org. This is the Sugar Association's website. They represent cane and beet sugar producers in the U.S. And at the time, they had a page on their website saying that sugar had been the subject of scientific scrutiny. More than 1,000 papers had dispelled the links between sugar and chronic disease. And they listed all of these major reviews, one by the FDA, two by the National Academy of Sciences, which had exonerated sugar from having a role in chronic disease. Again, I was a little bit baffled and didn't really understand how that could be. So on my own time, again, I started wondering more about these trade groups. Where did they come from? What had they been doing? And I lucked into finding a source of documents. Actually, my first one was at Colorado State University. I had board reports, financial statements, list of research projects funded by the Sugar Association. And when I saw this quote, I knew I was onto something good. The fact that no confirmed scientific evidence links sugar to the death-dealing disease is the lifeblood of the Sugar Association. This led to, I teamed up with Gary Taubes, who Ben mentioned in the beginning. His article, Is Sugar Toxic?, got lots of attention in the New York Times. And working with Gary, we were able to get the first story out on how the sugar industry actually influenced the 1976 FDA review on the safety of sugars. And that came out in 2012. That article led to a chance to come out to UCSF and connect with some of the great folks out here and allowed an opportunity for me to come out as a postdoctoral fellow. I'm in my second year now. I've got a wonderful team of interdisciplinary mentors and funders, including Stan Glantz from the Centers for Tobacco Research, Control, and Education, as well as Claire Brindis and Laura Schmidt at the Philip Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies, and the School of Dentistry as well, with John and Deborah Greenspan and Pamden Beston's group. And of course, there's so many wonderful people here that have generously spent their time with me, including Ernie. Are you here, Ernie Newbrun? Who had firsthand knowledge of the events that I studied in my first paper and generously came in to sit down and share some of his work with me. So, launching into the rest of the presentation, I want to start with a quote from Dr. Margaret Chan, who's the Director General of the World Health Organization, and provide a quote from her opening to the 8th Global Conference on Health Promotion in 2013, where she said, "Efforts to prevent non-communicable diseases go against the business interests of powerful economic operators. In my view, this is one of the biggest challenges facing health promotion. It is not just big tobacco anymore. Public health must also contend with big food, big soda, and big alcohol. All of these industries fear regulation and protect themselves by using the same tactics. I'm deeply concerned by efforts by industry to shape the public health policies and strategies that affect their products. When industry is involved in policymaking, rest assured that the most effective control measures will be downplayed or left out entirely." So who is the sugar industry? On a global scale, the sugar industry is the World Sugar Research Organization based in London. Again, they represent cane and beet sugar producers. This is from their website, where they advertise that they're researching the effects of sugar on nutrition, health and well-being worldwide. This is their membership. They have over 30 members, including the U.S. Sugar Association and Coca-Cola in the U.S. So they have quite a broad reach. And they publish position statements on everything from sugar and addiction to fat accumulation in the liver. The industry tactics that I'm going to focus on today have to do with industry manipulation of research. So I'm going to talk about forming research organizations, funding research to support the industry position, cultivating relationships with policymakers, and disseminating interest group data to those policymakers, all for the purpose of preventing or delaying regulation of a product. This slide compares tobacco industry research organizations with sugar industry research organizations. So above the timeline, you see the Tobacco Industry Research Committee, which was formed in 1954. It evolved into several different organizations, but was largely responsible for manufacturing doubt about the health effects of smoking. The line above represents the legacy tobacco documents library and the millions of pages that have come out related to litigation that have allowed researchers to truly understand industry tactics. Below the timeline represents the sugar industry research organizations, starting with the Sugar Research Foundation, which was actually formed as far back as 1943, and they evolved into several different organizations and are related today to the World Sugar Research Organization and the Sugar Association. And it's interesting to note that the Sugar Research Foundation was formed 9 years before the Tobacco Industry Research Committee. And in fact, some of the players in the Sugar Research Foundation went on to work for the big tobacco organizations. On the bottom line represents where I've been able to locate documents relative to the sugar industry. There's a big source of the University of Florida from the 40s, University of Illinois from the 50s and 60s, Great Western Sugar at Colorado State in the 70s, and even more recently, up until 2012, I was able to pull some documents down from the World Sugar Research Organization website that probably should have been password protected and were available for a short amount of time. So what I did for my first project was a historical documents analysis. So for the Mother Jones article, we had talked more about diabetes and heart disease. But as I was doing that work, I kept seeing all these references to dental caries, but I didn't really spend time on it. So this time, I went back to say, what was the sugar industry really looking at having to do with dental caries between this time period of 1959 to 1971? And Roger Adams was a member of the Sugar Research Foundation's Scientific Advisory Board. So he received all the communication from the Sugar Research Foundation and kept it and donated it to the library as part of his papers after he retired. This was an important time for dental caries research. It was during the early planning for the National Caries Program. President Johnson announced a new initiative to reappraise the research programs at NIH in 1966. Sugar was, sucrose in particular, I should say, was thought to be the arch criminal of dental caries at that time, the phrase coined by our own Ernie Newbern, I believe, based on the work of Fitzgerald and Kies at NIDR. It was called NIDR at the time, looking at strep mutans production of dextrans after being exposed to sucrose and the formation of sticky, tenacious plaque. So this research finding led sucrose to be put at the top of the list of the most cariogenic sugars. So the industry was under particular scrutiny at the time. We just recently published the results of this analysis together with Stan Glantz and Laura Schmidt in PLOS Medicine this past March. So the sugar industry pretty clearly stated their position on dental caries in 1950 in an annual report when they said, "The ultimate aim of the foundation in dental research has been to discover effective means of controlling tooth decay by methods other than restricting carbohydrate intake." So they were pretty clear all the way back in 1950. So they've got the research funding organization. So what did they do to fund research, looking at our second tactic? So we found that they funded research projects to divert attention away from limiting sugar intake. So beginning in 1967, the Sugar Research Foundation collaborated with the chocolate and confectionery industries, as a matter of fact. They contributed $85,000, the equivalent of today's dollars, which was only 4% of the overall budget of this project. And they studied dextranase enzymes with the intent to develop dextranases that could be added to foods, could be added to sugar, could be added to toothpaste or mouthwash, with the idea that you could continue to eat sugar and be able to break up the plaque having these dextranase enzymes added to foods. They also funded research on a dental caries vaccine. The third tactic, cultivating relationships with policymakers. As the NIDR's planning got underway in 1968 for the National Caries Program, the sugar industry reached out to leaders of NIDR. The Sugar Research Foundation became the International Sugar Research Foundation in 1968. They elected Philip Ross, and he'd worked for NIH between 1962 and 1967, and in fact, he'd been the chief of NIDR's research grants section between 63 and 65. The sugar industry also began holding a series of symposiums to evaluate the status of research on sugar and chronic disease, and they invited NIDR's intramural scientific director at the time, Richard Grulich, to present on the future of caries control. So the sugar industry got a firsthand look at some of the discussions that were going on at NIDR at the time. Interestingly, Grulich actually gave assurances to the sugar industry then that they weren't looking at limiting sugar intake as a practical, effective control measure for improving dental caries.
they continued to cultivate relationships with NIDR leaders and experts throughout 1969. NIDR formed a Caries Task Force Steering Committee to begin planning the research priorities for the National Caries Program. Names are listed in the first column with their affiliation. At the same time, the sugar industry formed their own expert panel to give them advice on their own research program. And when we compared the two, we found that all but one of the NIDR Task Force Committee also sat on the sugar industry's panel. So the sugar industry got direct access to the NIDR's expert panel planning the research priorities of the National Caries Program. In 1970, funding was approved for the National Caries Program. Research priorities hadn't yet been published, but the New York Times ran an article with the headline, "Halt in Tooth Decay in the 70s Foreseen." NIDR was working toward the goal of virtually eliminating tooth decay in the United States within a decade. The sugar industry clipped that New York Times article and sent it out to all of their members together with a celebratory memo describing their participation in the planning for the NIDR program. And they said the correlation between sugar and dental decay, a practical concern of the sugar industry for many years, may become purely an academic issue within the foreseeable future. They mentioned that Dr. Philip Ross, their president, met with the Dental Caries Task Force and had worked closely with its chairman, Henry Sherp. Dental Caries Research 1969, which was a report prepared several months ago by the staff of ISRF, was submitted to the task force for its consideration. Which brings us to the fourth tactic of disseminating interest group data directly to policymakers. So the sugar industry's report on dental caries research was submitted to NIDR. We located NIDR's first request for contracts relating to the National Caries Program that was published in 1971. We found that 78% of the sugar industry document was directly incorporated into the NIDR's planning document for research priorities for the Caries program. And not only that, but 40% of the research priorities discussed in the NIDR document were either taken verbatim or closely paraphrased from the sugar industry document. As an example, from the sugar document, it said, "But since it is not practicable to replace sucrose in our diet, can anything be added to mitigate its carcinogenicity? Phosphates are a possible answer. If it is not practicable to replace sucrose in our diet, can anything be added to mitigate its carcinogenicity? Phosphates are a possible answer." Looking at the two documents and comparing the research priorities identified and promoted by the sugar industry to those of the NIDR task force, and then what ended up in the final request for contracts, there are a lot of similarities, particularly on non-dietary interventions. So both sides agreed to fund research for dextranase, antimicrobials, antibiotics, caries vaccine, water fluoridation, topical fluoride, and sealants. On the dietary intervention side, both sides agreed to fund research related to dietary phosphates. Where there was disagreement was research supporting the carcinogenic potential of foods, developing a measure to be able to categorize foods as being either safe or harmful to teeth. And this was something that the Caries Task Force at NIDR was interested in supporting and developing, but for obvious reasons, the sugar industry was not interested in developing such a test. And this research priority was left out of the 1971 request for contracts. So it was something that NIDR did not give research priority to as part of the National Caries Program. The NIDR task force, though, did hold a workshop dedicated to looking at human foodstuffs and caries in 1970. This was before that first request for contracts came out. All of the members agreed that it was desirable to have a relatively speedy and economical method of evaluating carcinogenicity, especially of snack-type foods, so that parents can be warned against the more destructive products. A quick screening method is needed to provide presumptive evidence of the potential carcinogenicity of accepted foods and new products that appear almost daily on the shelves of food markets. But at that workshop, there were over 10 presenters discussing many different methods to be able to measure the carcinogenicity of foods. Do you do it in animal models, human models, in vitro, in vivo? Do you look at bacterial acid production? Do you look at enamel dissolution? There's so many different ways to measure the carcinogenic potential of foods that it was needed to have a discussion to standardize, to come up with a way to create one method to quantitatively be able to categorize foods as either safe or harmful to teeth. So what are the implications for oral health, particularly of the 1971 research priorities released by NIDR? Looking at the results within a decade, certainly there were successes. Sealants were advanced quite a bit than topical fluoride, looking at school fluoridation programs, expanding water fluoridation. But there were some key failures. So some of the initial priorities promoted, such as the dextrinases, the phosphates, the caries vaccine at the time, that research failed to be developed into practical applications. In a 1980 prevalence survey, 64% of children were found to have dental caries, falling far short of the goal of eradicating tooth decay within a decade. And because NIDR did not take up funding of carcinogenicity research in any major way, that research was then taken up by the American Dental Association Health Foundation and had significant industry participation. So, preventing regulation. Just around the corner from the National Caries Program, the FDA actually began to consider the idea of a dental warning label for foods. The FDA's Sanford Miller actually addressed the ADA Health Foundation examining the carcinogenicity work. And he told them, one does not always require a perfect system, simply one that can separate foods into broad categories reflecting potential hazard. This research must become a high-priority effort, funded adequately, and performed well. If this support, data, and techniques are not forthcoming, the decisions will be made without the appropriate scientific input, the principal effort occurring in response to considerations other than scientific. Other initiatives that were being considered in the 1970s had to do with limiting exposure of advertising of sugary products to children. The FTC had an initiative called KidVid, which was looking at the time slot of Saturday morning cartoons and looking at identifying highly sugared products and either limiting or banning advertising. Another initiative was part of Healthy People 1990, which was planned in 1980, looking at removing highly sugared products from school vending machines. All three of these initiatives, the FDA warning label, FTC, and Healthy People, were dependent on developing a measure of the carcinogenic potential of foods to be able to put foods into safe and harmful categories. Now, of course, there was a lot of opposition to all of these proposals, as you can imagine, from many different industries, including the advertising industry. And it failed, all three of them, for many reasons. But one key factor was the fact that a carcinogenicity test was never agreed upon to support these regulations. In 1991, Basil Bibby, who had served on the NIDR's caries task force and had led the workshop looking at human foodstuffs and caries, reflected back on the work of the past couple decades, looking at the ADA committee that had been examining carcinogenicity, and he said, the original objective to develop ways that could be relied upon to show which foods were more or less carcinogenic was not achieved. The reasons for this are, first and foremost, that the problem is more complex than anticipated, and secondarily, the hoped-for supply of research funding from the federal government or industry was not forthcoming. So the next major labeling initiative came in 1990 through the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act, and this is what gave us the Nutrition Facts Panel. And what's interesting to note is that the nutrients in yellow, total fat, cholesterol, and sodium are all nutrients to limit. And all those nutrients have a designated quantitative daily limit associated with those nutrients. But when you see sugars in white, There is no daily limit for sugars. And this is how our Nutrition Facts Panel was introduced. The other thing that was important about this act is it loosened up some of the previous regulations on health claims that could go on to food products. So that gave us the fat-free, low-calorie era. So this slide shows the original snack pack of chocolate pudding, 16 grams of sugar, now can be advertised as fat-free, only 80 calories, but the sugar really didn't change. It went from 16 grams to 15 grams. So we went from trying to categorize foods as either safe or harmful to actually promoting highly sugared foods by allowing these claims of fat-free and low-calorie foods. And we're promoting them to kids. Here's Disney's Finding Nemo on Kellogg's chewy, I'm not even sure what those are, little nuggets of starch and sugar. And they can be promoted as being healthy. Look at all the claims that are on this. Now gluten-free, 100% daily vitamin C, only 70 calories, fat-free, made with real fruit because it contains a tiny bit of apple juice concentrate. Capitalizing on the organic craze are these yummy Earth Pops made with organic fruit juice, USDA certified organic, gluten-free, fat-free, nut-free, and 100% vegan. So we're marketing highly sugared products as healthy foods. Interestingly, in 1996, the FDA approved a dental health claim for products. So the sugar alcohols, artificial sweeteners, are allowed to use a claim of does not promote tooth decay in this example. And they actually base this claim on a carcinogenicity test. So the FDA allows us to talk about safe foods, but we haven't applied that same test to talk about foods that are not safe for teeth. And as Carol mentioned earlier, there are several proposals going on right now related to food policy and sugar, particularly the FDA's review of the Nutrition Facts Panel. You might notice some of the changes, having the calories much bigger type, calling attention to the number of servings per container. They're moving the percent daily value to be the first column. But the biggest change related to sugars is actually adding a line for added sugars so that people can understand how much is actually added to their products. This isn't a done deal. The public comment period is over, and the FDA is now considering whether they'll go forward with this change. The FDA, however, did not make a recommendation for a daily limit on added sugars, but this is where the 2015 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee comes in, who actually has made a recommendation to include the less than 10% of daily added sugars as a daily limit that could be used as a daily reference value to go on these packaged products, which could actually have an impact in limiting some of those health claims that are now being used to promote sugary products. This 2015 Dietary Guidelines recommendation on added sugars is based largely on the very recent guideline put out by the World Health Organization on sugars intake for adults and children. And the evidence reviewed for this report was largely based on obesity and dental caries, and we're so lucky to have Paula Moynihan here, who's going to give us a firsthand account of that process. Of course, the sugar industry is a little bit worried about this. This is a 20-ounce bottle of Coke, which comes with 65 grams of sugar. For a 2,000-calorie diet, a 10% limit is 50 grams of sugar, which is only 3/4 of a 20-ounce Coke. So this could have a significant impact on the sugar industry. The last time the WHO made a recommendation on a daily limit was back in 2002, 2003. the sugar industry mounted a fierce opposition to that report, and the quantitative limit on added sugars was left out of the 2003 global strategy on diet and health put out by the WHO and the FAO. And on the American side, the U.S., the sugar industry fought to keep that WHO recommendation from being incorporated into the 2005 dietary guidelines. And they used some pretty severe tactics, as this article reported. The threat was being described by WHO insiders as tantamount to blackmail and worse than any pressure exerted by the tobacco lobby. The sugar industry threatened to get Congress on its side and pull funding from the WHO, and they said they would exercise every avenue available to expose the dubious nature of the report. And while that report still exists, it still does have the 10% limit, it was never incorporated into final policy in either the WHO or here in the U.S. So this 2015 dietary guidelines proposal is actually quite important and could be quite an historic event for the U.S. related to sugar consumption. And I'm very pleased to hear that the American Dental Association has testified and commented related to this. So in conclusion, sugar industry tactics to impact the NIDR 1971 research priorities echo tobacco industry tactics. The NIDR National Caries Program was a missed opportunity to support regulation to reduce dental caries. And dental voices are needed to counter sugar industry opposition to current policy proposals. Thank you very much.
So we heard earlier from Dr. Carol Summerhays, representing the American Dental Association, and we are very proud here in California to have a Californian getting ready to take the reins as the leader of that organization when her term as president begins at the end of this year. We're also very proud here in Northern California that for the second straight year we'll have a Bay Area president of the California Dental Association. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Walt Weber, who's the leader of that group, and he's going to share a few thoughts from the CDA.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for inviting me. I want to thank Dr. Featherstone and Dr. Chaffee for this kind of invitation. I'm talking a little bit about California Dental Association and kind of what we're doing here in the state. California Dental Association has been engaged in policies and programs to reduce barriers to dental care and improve the oral health of Californians for many years now, and we're very proud of the work we do. Many of you may be aware of our efforts, including that the most obvious thing, the most visible, I think, event that we do is CDA Cares, which provides essential basic dental services to Californians experiencing active dental pain and infection. Over the last 3 years, we have provided, this charity event has provided $11 million worth of work to 13,000 patients. And of course, that's all great for the people that are there, but we really look at this as a platform. We use this event as a platform to educate the public, legislators. We had our last event in Sacramento. We had many legislators there, policymakers, people that are making decisions on that. And so we educate the public and the legislators to understand the importance of oral health care, showing what happens that people waiting in line overnight are having toothaches and having to have teeth extracted. And if we understand the importance of prevention, all of us in this room understand that. And we're trying to get people to understand that. The state dropped a lot of preventive programs over the years, and we're trying to showcase that if you can prevent problems early, we can maybe eliminate a lot of the problems people are having. In 2011, the CDA completed a multi-year extensive research project on strategies to reduce barriers to dental care. And the body of work produced a proposal of over 20 recommendations in a three-phase approach over 7 years, and serves as our framework for our continued activity and advocacy to improve access to dental services for California's most vulnerable and underserved populations. We are particularly excited, as a top priority of that work was to bring in a dental director to the state to provide leadership and direction to dental public health efforts. We understand that appointment is imminent, we think in June, and we look forward to working closely with the director and the Department of Public Health to rebuild California's dental public health infrastructure, bringing back those prevention programs that were lost. Additionally, CDA has worked tirelessly on community water fluoridation, most recently supporting the defeat of a ballot measure this past November to terminate community water fluoridation in Healdsburg, which was actually the first California community to fluoridate, and continuing efforts to fluoridate the last remaining large city, San Jose, with community water fluoridation. So these are just some of the things we do, and I'd like to take some of the time here to highlight an opportunity to prevent dental disease. This is an approach that is recognized as beneficial, and efforts have begun, but it is really worth more of our focus, especially as it relates to developing healthy eating, drinking, and snacking behaviors for children. You know, for many years, there's been a one-year age one recommendation for many years for a child's first dental visit. But unfortunately, that hasn't really been as effective in accomplishing the goal of getting children to dentists early enough to prevent disease in the populations most at risk. We see that despite the recommendation, many parents still don't take their children to the dentist before the disease process gets a foothold. Far too many visits are after the caries process has started. And adding to that, we know that many dentists still feel uncomfortable treating children under three. But most infants do see a pediatrician, family practice provider, and this is where the opportunity lies. The California Dental Association Foundation recognized the benefit of very early dental disease prevention over a decade ago when we collaborated on a multi-year project to train dental and medical providers in early risk assessment, anticipatory guidance, and fluoride varnish applications for children ages 0 to 5. Called First Smiles, the foundation was responsible for training dentists, and the Center for Oral Health trained medical providers. And I would characterize First Smiles as an early effort at medical dental integration. Of course, UCSF is at the forefront of doing that. And we're hearing more about this term every day as the benefits of coordinated integrated care are part of the national conversation. And in the years since First Smiles program, some things have changed. California and many other states encourage early dental disease prevention by reimbursing medical providers for applying fluoride varnish. University dental and medical programs are providing more opportunities for interprofessional education and collaboration during the education process. And the patient-centered dental health home is being widely promoted in safety net clinics where medical and dental providers are often co-located and can provide a full range of coordinated patient care. Well, these are all good signs heading us in the right direction, but as I stated earlier, we don't yet see this translating into measurable change, especially for the high-risk populations. We know there is more work to be done. Here are some things that need to occur to make the promise of dental disease prevention more of a reality. A stronger, renewed focus on the education of medical providers, especially pediatricians and OBGYNs, that preventing the onset of dental disease begins at birth. Broader expectations for pediatricians to incorporate oral health education and anticipatory guidance into infant well child visits. Central to this is guidance on healthy eating, drinking, and snacking behaviors. This guidance must start before teeth erupt, which means the pediatrician must be engaged in these prevention activities. Even a few basic questions starts the important conversation about what parents can do to prevent dental disease onset. Children identified at high risk should be referred immediately to a dentist, and those at low risk are more able to be managed and their disease prevented at earlier ages through their visits with the pediatrician. This requires continued evaluation by the pediatrician at each visit with a change in risk requiring a readjustment in disease prevention activities and engagement of a dentist. This cannot happen unless both professions work closely together, which means strong communication and supported successful referral processes. We look forward to a time when children whose circumstances place them at high risk at birth become low risk because of the combined efforts of dentists and our partners in chronic disease prevention, pediatricians, and family health providers. Before I close, I want to share a little bit of information specifically about CD's activity to reduce soda and sugary beverage consumption. Several years ago, as the first attempts to reduce consumption via taxes or fees surfaced in the California legislature, CDA pursued research to establish the nexus between soda consumption and caries that would allow a fee on soda rather than a tax. And though legislative attempts to levy a tax or tax persists and have so far failed, CDA continues to offer support on the science and educates legislators and legislative staff on the oral consequences of sugary beverage consumption. So our policy is that we support fees or taxes on sugar-containing beverages. And in fact, we supported the San Francisco Initiative and actually financially supported as well. And of course, that was one where some of the money that came out of that would be directed towards oral health care as well, which is even a better win because you're hopefully reducing demand at the front end, and at the end we're getting money to go back to start prevention programs. So that I think that the organization feels that's a great approach if you can actually get money to go to something that's going to help the oral health care. So we're proud of what we do, and our members are proud to do the best we can for our patients and communities. And I want to thank you again for letting me speak here today, and thanks again for this great conference. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.